War Game by Philip K. Dick. In his office at the Terran Import Bureau of Standards, the tall man gathered up the morning's memos from their wire basket and, seating himself at his desk, arranged them for reading. He put on his iris lenses, lit a cigarette. "Good morning," the first memo said in its tinny, chattery voice as Wiseman ran his thumb along the line of pasted tape. Staring off through the open window at the parking lot, he listened to it idly. "Say, look, what's wrong with you people down there? We sent that lot of..." A pause as the speaker, the sales manager of a chain of New York department stores, found his records. "Those Ganymedean toys. You realize we have to get them approved in time for the autumn buying plan so we can get them stocked for Christmas." Grumbling, the sales manager concluded, "War games are going to be an important item again this year. We intend to buy big." Wiseman ran his thumb down to the speaker's name and title. "Joe Houck," the memo voice chattered. "Apley's Children's." To himself, Wiseman said, "Ah." He put down the memo, got a blank, and prepared to reply. And then he said half aloud, "Yes, what about that lot of Ganymedean toys?" It seemed like a long time that the testing labs had been on them, at least 2 weeks. Of course, any Ganymedean products got special attention these days. The Moons had, during the last year, gotten beyond their usual state of economic greed and had begun, according to intelligence circles, mulling overt military action against competitive interests, of which the inner three planets could be called the foremost element. But so far, nothing had shown up. Exports remained of adequate quality, with no special jokers, no toxic paint to be licked off, no capsules of bacteria. And yet, any group of people as inventive as the Ganymedians could be expected to show creativity in whatever field they entered. Subversion would be tackled like any other venture, with imagination and a flair for wit. Wiseman got to his feet and left his office, in the direction of the separate building in which the testing labs operated. Surrounded by half-disassembled consumers' products, Penario looked up to see his boss, Leon Wiseman, shutting the final door of the lab. "I'm glad you came down," Penario said, although actually he was stalling. He knew that he was at least 5 days behind in his work, and this session was going to mean trouble. "Better put on a prophylaxis suit. Don't want to take risks." He spoke pleasantly, but Wiseman's expression remained dour. "I'm here about those inner citadel storming shock troops at $6 a set," Wiseman said, strolling among the stacks of many-sized, unopened products waiting to be tested and released. "Oh, that set of Ganymedean toy soldiers," Penario said with relief. His conscience was clear on that item. Every tester in the labs knew the special instructions handed down by the Cheyenne government on the dangers of contamination from culture particles hostile to innocent urban populations, a typically muddy U-case from officialdom. He could always legitimately fall back and cite the number of that directive. "I've got them off by themselves," he said, walking over to accompany Wiseman, "due to the special danger involved." "Let's have a look," Wiseman said. "Do you believe there's anything in this caution, or is it more paranoia about alien milieu?" Penario said, "It's justified, especially where children's artifacts are concerned." A few hand signals and a slab of wall exposed a side room. Propped up in the center was a sight that caused Wiseman to halt. A plastic life-size dummy of a child, perhaps 5 years in appearance, wearing ordinary clothes, sat surrounded by toys. At this moment, the dummy was saying, "I'm tired of that. Do something else." It paused a short time and then repeated, "I'm tired of that. Do something else." The toys on the floor, triggered to respond to oral instructions, gave up their various occupations and started afresh. "It saves on labor costs," Penario explained. This is a crop of junk that's got an entire repertoire to go through before the buyer has his money's worth. If we stuck around to keep them active, we'd be in here all the time. Directly before the dummy was the group of Ganymedean soldiers, plus the citadel which they had been built to storm. They had been sneaking up on it in an elaborate pattern, but at the dummy's utterance they had halted. Now they were regrouping. "You getting all this on tape?" Wiseman asked. "Oh, yes," Panario said. The model soldiers stood approximately 6 inches high, made from the almost indestructible thermoplastic compounds that the Ganymedean manufacturers were famous for. Their uniforms were synthetic, a hodgepodge of various military costumes from the moons and nearby planets. The citadel itself, a block of ominous dark metal-like stuff, resembled a legendary fort. Peepholes dotted its upper surfaces, a drawbridge had been drawn up out of sight, and from the top turret a gaudy flag waved. With a whistling pop, the citadel fired a projectile at its attackers. The projectile exploded in a cloud of harmless smoke and noise among a cluster of soldiers. "It fights back," Wiseman observed. "But ultimately it loses," Panario said. "It has to. Psychologically speaking, it symbolizes the external reality. The dozen soldiers, of course, represent to the child his own efforts to cope. By participating in the storming of the citadel, the child undergoes a sense of adequacy in dealing with the harsh world. Eventually, he prevails, but only after a painstaking period of effort and patience." He added, "Anyhow, that's what the instruction booklet says." He handed Wiseman the booklet. Glancing over the booklet, Wiseman asked, "And their pattern of assault varies each time?" "We've had it running for 8 days now. The same pattern hasn't cropped up twice." "Well, you've got quite a few units involved." The soldiers were sneaking around, gradually nearing the citadel. On the walls, a number of monitoring devices appeared and began tracking the soldiers. Utilizing other toys being tested, the soldiers concealed themselves. "They can incorporate accidental configurations of terrain," Panario explained. "They're object tropic. When they see, for example, a dollhouse here for testing, they climb into it like mice. They'll be all through it." To prove his point, he picked up a large toy spaceship manufactured by a Uranian company. Shaking it, he spilled two soldiers from it. "How many times do they take the citadel?" Wiseman asked, "on a percentage basis." "So far, they've been successful 1 out of 9 tries. There's an adjustment in the back of the citadel. You can set it for a higher yield of successful tries." He threaded a path through the advancing soldiers. Wiseman accompanied him, and they bent down to inspect the citadel. "This is actually the power supply," Panario said. "Cunning. Also, the instructions to the soldiers emanate from it. High-frequency transmission from a shot box." Opening the back of the citadel, he showed his boss the container of shot. Each shot was an instruction iota. For an assault pattern, the shot were tossed up, vibrated, allowed to settle in a new sequence. Randomness was thereby achieved. But since there was a finite number of shot, there had to be a finite number of patterns. "We're trying them all," Panario said. "And there's no way to speed it up. It'll just have to take time. It may run through 1,000 patterns, and then..." "The next one," Wiseman finished, "may have them make a 90-degree turn and start firing at the nearest human being." Panario said somberly, "Or worse, there are a good deal of ergs in that power pack. It's made to put out for 5 years. But if it all went into something simultaneously..." "Keep testing," Wiseman said. They looked at each other and then at the citadel. The soldiers had by now almost reached it. Suddenly, one wall of the citadel flapped down. A gun muzzle appeared, and the soldiers had been flattened. "I never saw that before," Panario murmured. For a moment, nothing stirred. And then the lab's child dummy, seated among its toys, said, I'm tired of that. Do something else. With a tremor of uneasiness, the two men watched the soldiers pick themselves up and regroup. Two days later, Wiseman's superior, a heavy-set, short, angry man with popping eyes, appeared in his office. Listen, Fowler said. You get those damn toys out of testing. I'll give you until tomorrow. He started back out, but Wiseman stopped him. This is too serious, he said. Come down to the lab and I'll show you. Arguing all the way, Fowler accompanied him to the lab. You have no concept of the capital some of these firms have invested in this stuff, he was saying as they entered. For every product you've got represented here, there's a ship or a warehouse full on Luna, waiting for official clearance so it can come in. Pinario was nowhere in sight, so Wiseman used his key, bypassing the hand signals that opened up the testing room. There, surrounded by toys, sat the dummy that the lab men had built. Around it, the numerous toys went through their cycles. The racket made Fowler wince. This is the item in particular, Wiseman said, bending down by the Citadel. A soldier was in the process of squirming on his belly toward it. As you can see, there are a dozen soldiers. Given that many, and the energy available to them, plus the complex instruction data, Fowler interrupted. I see only 11. One's probably hiding, Wiseman said. From behind him, a voice said, No, he's right. Pinario, a rigid expression on his face, appeared. I've been having a search made. One is gone. The three men were silent. Maybe the Citadel destroyed him, Wiseman finally suggested. Pinario said, There's a law of matter dealing with that. If it destroyed him, what did it do with the remains? Possibly converted him into energy, Fowler said, examining the Citadel and the remaining soldiers. We did something ingenious, Pinario said, when we realized that a soldier was gone. We weighed the remaining 11 plus the Citadel. Their combined weight is exactly equal to that of the original set, the original dozen soldiers and the Citadel. So he's in there somewhere. He pointed at the Citadel, which at the moment was pinpointing the soldiers advancing toward it. Studying the Citadel, Wiseman had a deep intuitive feeling. It had changed. It was, in some manner, different. Run your tapes, Wiseman said. What? Asked Pinario, and then he flushed. Of course. Going to the child dummy, he shut it off, opened it, and removed the drum of video recording tape. Shakily, he carried it to the projector. They sat watching the recording sequences flash by. One assault after another until the three of them were bleary-eyed. The soldiers advanced, retreated, were fired on, picked themselves up, advanced again. Stop the transport, Wiseman said suddenly. The last sequence was rerun. A soldier moved steadily toward the base of the Citadel. A missile fired at him, exploded, and for a time obscured him. Meanwhile, the other 11 soldiers scurried in a wild attempt to mount the walls. The soldier emerged from the cloud of dust and continued. He reached the wall. A section slid back. The soldier, blending with the dingy wall of the Citadel, used the end of his rifle as a screwdriver to remove his head, then one arm, then both legs. The disassembled pieces were passed into the aperture of the Citadel. When only the arm and rifle remained, that too crawled into the Citadel, worming blindly, and vanished. The aperture slid out of existence. After a long time, Fowler said in a hoarse voice, The presumption by the parent would be that the child had lost or destroyed one of the soldiers. Gradually, the set would dwindle, with the child getting the blame. Pinario said, What do you recommend? Keep it in action, Fowler said with a nod from Wiseman. Let it work out its cycle, but don't leave it alone. I'll have somebody in the room with it from now on, Penario said.
Better yet, stay with it yourself, Fowler said.
To himself, Wiseman thought, maybe we all better stay with it. At least two of us, Penario and myself. I wonder what it did with the pieces, he thought. What did it make? By the end of the week, the Citadel had absorbed four more of the soldiers. Watching it through a monitor, Wiseman could see in it no visible change. Naturally, the growth would be strictly internal, down out of sight. On and on the eternal assaults, the soldiers wriggling up, the Citadel firing in defense. Meanwhile, he had before him a new series of Ganymedean products. More recent children's toys to be inspected. Now what? He asked himself. The first was an apparently simple item. A cowboy costume from the ancient American West. At least so it was described. But he paid only cursory attention to the brochure. The hell with what the Ganymedians had to say about it. Opening the box, he laid out the costume. The fabric had a gray, amorphous quality. What a miserably bad job, he thought. It only vaguely represented a cowboy suit. The lines seemed unformed, hesitant, and the material stretched out of shape as he handled it. He found that he had pulled an entire section of it into a pocket that hung down. I don't get it, he said to Penario. This won't sell. Put it on, Penario said. You'll see. With effort, Wiseman managed to squeeze himself into the suit. Is it safe? He asked. Yes, Penario said. I had it on earlier. This is a more benign idea, but it could be effective. To start it into action, you fantasize. Along what lines? Any lines. The suit made Wiseman think of cowboys, and so he imagined to himself that he was back at the ranch, trudging along the gravel road by the field in which black-faced sheep munched hay with that odd, rapid grinding motion of their lower jaws. He had stopped at the fence, barbed wire and occasional upright posts, and watched the sheep. Then, without warning, the sheep lined up and headed off in the direction of a shaded hillside beyond his range of vision. He saw trees, cypress growing against the skyline. A chicken hawk far up flapped its wings in a pumping action. As if, he thought, it's filling itself with more air to rise higher. The hawk glided energetically off, then sailed at a leisurely pace. Wiseman looked for a sign of its prey. Nothing but the dry midsummer fields munched flat by the sheep, frequent grasshoppers, and on the road itself a toad. The toad had burrowed into the loose dirt, only its top part was visible. As he bent down, trying to get up enough courage to touch the warty top of the toad's head, a man's voice said nearby him, "How do you like it?" "Fine," Wiseman said. He took a deep breath of the dry grass smell. He filled his lungs. "Hey, how do you tell a female toad from a male toad? By the spots or what?" "Why?" asked the man, standing behind him, slightly out of sight. "I've got a toad here." "Just for the record," the man said, "can I ask you a couple of questions?" "Sure," Wiseman said. "How old are you?" That was easy. 10 years and 4 months, he said with pride. "Where exactly are you at this moment?" "Out in the country, Mr. Gaylord's ranch, where my dad takes me and my mother every weekend when we can." "Turn around and look at me," the man said. "And tell me if you know me." With reluctance, he turned from the half-buried toad to look. He saw an adult with a thin face and a long, somewhat irregular nose. "You're the man who delivers the butane gas," he said, "for the butane company." He glanced around, and sure enough, there was the truck, parked by the butane gate. "My dad says butane is expensive, but there's no other," the man broke in. "Just for the sake of curiosity, what's the name of the butane company?" "It's right on the truck," Wiseman said, reading the large painted letters. Panario Butane Distributors, Petaluma, California. You're Mr. Panario. Would you be willing to swear that you're 10 years old, standing in a field near Petaluma, California? Mr. Panario asked. Sure. He could see beyond the field a range of wooded hills. Now he wanted to investigate them. He was tired of standing around gabbing. I'll see you, he said, starting off. I have to go get some hiking done. He started running away from Mr. Panario down the gravel road. Grasshoppers leaped away ahead of him. Gasping, he ran faster and faster. Leon, Mr. Panario called after him. You might as well give up. Stop running. I've got business in those hills, Wiseman panted, still jogging along. Suddenly, something struck him full force. He sprawled on his hands, tried to get back up. In the dry midday air, something shimmered. He felt fear and pulled away from it. A shape formed, a flat wall. You won't get to those hills, Mr. Panario said from behind him. Better stay in roughly one place, otherwise you collide with things. Wiseman's hands were damp with blood. He had cut himself falling. In bewilderment, he stared down at the blood. Panario helped him out of the cowboy suit, saying, It's as unwholesome a toy as you could want. A short period with it on, and the child would be unable to face contemporary reality. Look at you. Standing with difficulty, Wiseman inspected the suit. Panario had forcibly taken it from him. Not bad, he said in a trembling voice. It obviously stimulates the withdrawal tendencies already present. I know I've always had a latent retreat fantasy toward my childhood. That particular period, when we lived in the country. Notice how you incorporated real elements into it, Panario said. To keep the fantasy going as long as possible. If you'd had time, you would have figured a way of incorporating the lab wall into it. Possibly as the side of a barn. Wiseman admitted, I already had started to see the old dairy building where the farmers brought their market milk. In time, Panario said, it would have been next to impossible to get you out of it. To himself, Wiseman thought, if it could do that to an adult, just imagine the effect on a child. That other thing you have there, Panario said, that game, it's a screwball notion. You feel like looking at it now? It can wait. I'm okay, Wiseman said. He picked up the third item and began to open it. A lot like the old game of Monopoly, Panario said. It's called Syndrome. The game consisted of a board, plus play money, dice, pieces to represent the players, and stock certificates. You acquire stock, Panario said. Same as in all this kind, obviously. He didn't even bother to look at the instructions. Let's get Fowler down here and play a hand. It takes at least three. Shortly, they had the division director with them. The three men seated themselves at a table, the game of Syndrome in the center. Each player starts out equal with the others, Panario explained, same as all this type. And during the play, their statuses change according to the worth of the stock they acquire in various economic syndromes. The syndromes were represented by small, bright plastic objects, much like the archaic hotels and houses of Monopoly. They threw the dice, moved their counters along the board, bid for and acquired property, paid fines, collected fines, went to the decontamination chamber for a period. Meanwhile, behind them, the seven model soldiers crept up on the citadel again and again. I'm tired of that, the child dummy said. Do something else. The soldiers regrouped. Once more they started out, getting nearer and nearer the citadel. Restless and irritable, Wiseman said, I wonder how long that damn thing has to go on before we find out what it's for. No telling. Panario eyed a purple and gold share of stock that Fowler had acquired. I can use that, he said. That's a heavy uranium mine stock on Pluto. What do you want for it? Valuable property, Fowler murmured, consulting his other stocks.
I might make a trade, though. How can I concentrate on a game, Wiseman asked himself, when that thing is getting closer and nearer to God knows what, to whatever it was built to reach? It's critical mass, he thought. Just a second, he said in a slow, careful voice. He put down his hand of stocks. Could that citadel be a pile?
Pile of what?
Fowler asked, concerned with his hand. Wiseman said loudly, forget this game. An interesting idea, Penario said, also putting down his hand. It's constructing itself into an atomic bomb, piece by piece. Adding until... He broke off. No, we thought of that. There are no heavy elements present in it. It's simply a 5-year battery, plus a number of small machines controlled by instructions broadcast from the battery itself. You can't make an atomic pile out of that. In my opinion, Wiseman said, we'd be safer getting it out of here. His experience with the cowboy suit had given him a great deal more respect for the Ganymedean artificers. And if the suit was the benign one. Fowler, looking past his shoulder, said,
there are only 6 soldiers now.
Both Wiseman and Canario got up instantly. Fowler was right. Only half of the set of soldiers remained. One more had reached the citadel and been incorporated. Let's get a bomb expert from the military services in here, Wiseman said. Let him check it. This is out of our department. He turned to his boss, Fowler. Don't you agree? Fowler said,
Let's finish this game first.
Why?
Because we want to be certain about it, Fowler said.
But his rapt interest showed that he had gotten emotionally involved and wanted to play to the end of the game.
What will you give me for this share of Pluto stock? I'm open to offers.
He and Penario negotiated a trade. The game continued for another hour. At last, all 3 of them could see that Fowler was gaining control of the various stocks. He had 5 mining syndromes, plus 2 plastics firms, an algae monopoly, and all 7 of the retail trading syndromes. Due to his control of the stock, he had, as a byproduct, gotten most of the money. I'm out, Penario said. All he had left were minor shares which controlled nothing. Anybody want to buy these? With his last remaining money, Wiseman bid for the shares. He got them and resumed playing, this time against Fowler alone. It's clear that this game is a replica of typical interculture economic ventures, Wiseman said. The retail trading syndromes are obviously Ganymedean holdings. A flicker of excitement stirred in him. He had gotten a couple of good throws with the dice and was in a position to add a share to his meager holdings. Children playing this would acquire a healthy attitude toward economic realities. It would prepare them for the adult world. But a few minutes later, he landed on an enormous tract of Fowler holdings, and the fine wiped out his resources. He had to give up 2 shares of stock. The end was in sight. Penario, watching the soldiers advance toward the citadel, said, you know, Leon, I'm inclined to agree with you. This thing may be one terminal of a bomb, a receiving station of some kind. When it's completely wired up, it might bring in a surge of power transmitted from Ganymede.
Is such a thing possible? Fowler asked, stacking his play money into different denominations.
Who knows what they can do, Penario said, wandering around with his hands in his pockets. Are you almost finished playing?
Just about, Wiseman said.
The reason I say that, Penario said, is that now there are only 5 soldiers. It's speeding up. It took a week for the first one, and only an hour for the 7th. I wouldn't be surprised if the rest go within the next 2 hours, all 5 of them.
We're finished, Fowler said. He had acquired the last share of stock and the last dollar.
Wiseman arose from the table, leaving Fowler. I'll call military services to check the citadel. About this game, though, it's nothing but a steal from our Terran game Monopoly. Possibly they don't realize that we have the game already, Fowler said, under another name.
A stamp of admissibility was placed on the game of syndrome, and the importer was informed. In his office, Wiseman called military services and told them what he wanted.
A bomb expert will be right over, the unhurried voice at the other end of the line said. Probably you should leave the object alone until he arrives.
Feeling somewhat useless, Wiseman thanked the clerk and hung up. They had failed to dope out the soldiers and Citadel war game. Now it was out of their hands. The bomb expert was a young man with close-cropped hair who smiled friendlily at them as he set down his equipment. He wore ordinary coveralls with no protective devices. My first advice, he said after he had looked the Citadel over, is to disconnect the leads from the battery. Or if you want, we can let the cycle finish out and then disconnect the leads before any reaction takes place. In other words, allow the last mobile elements to enter the Citadel. Then, as soon as they're inside, we disconnect the leads and open her up and see what's been taking place. Is it safe? Wiseman asked. I think so, the bomb expert said. I don't detect any sign of radioactivity in it. He seated himself on the floor by the rear of the Citadel with a pair of cutting pliers in his hand. Now, only three soldiers remained.
Shouldn't be long, the young man said cheerfully.
15 minutes later, one of the three soldiers crept up to the base of the Citadel, removed his head, arm, legs, body, and disappeared piecemeal into the opening provided for him.
That leaves two, Fowler said.
10 minutes later, one of the two remaining soldiers followed the one ahead of him. The four men looked at each other.
This is almost it, Panario said huskily.
The last remaining soldier wove his way toward the Citadel. Guns within the Citadel fired at him, but he continued to make progress. Statistically speaking, Wiseman said aloud to break some of the tension, it should take longer each time, because there are fewer men for it to concentrate on. It should have started out fast, then got more infrequent until finally this last soldier should put in at least a month trying to
pipe down, the young bomb expert said in a quiet, reasonable voice, if you don't mind.
The last of the 12 soldiers reached the base of the Citadel. Like those before him, he began to disassemble himself.
Get those pliers ready, Panario grated.
The parts of the soldier traveled into the Citadel. The opening began to close. From within, a humming became audible, a rising pitch of activity.
Now, for God's sake, Fowler cried.
The young bomb expert reached down his pliers and cut into the positive lead of the battery. A spark flashed from the pliers, and the young bomb expert jumped reflexively. The pliers flew from his hands and skidded across the floor.
Geez, he said. I must have been grounded.
Groggily, he groped about for the pliers.
You were touching the frame of the thing, Panario said excitedly.
He grabbed the pliers himself and crouched down, fumbling for the lead.
Maybe if I wrap a handkerchief around it, he muttered, withdrawing the pliers and fishing in his pocket for a handkerchief. Anybody got anything I can wrap around this? I don't want to get knocked flat. No telling how many...
Give it to me, Wiseman demanded, snatching the pliers from him.
He shoved Panario aside and closed the jaws of the pliers around the lead. Fowler said calmly,
Too late.
Wiseman hardly heard his supervisor's voice. He heard the constant tone within his head, and he put up his hands to his ears, futilely trying to shut it out. Now it seemed to pass directly from the Citadel through his skull, transmitted by the bone. We stalled around too long, he thought. Now it has us. It won out because there are too many of us. We got to squabbling. Within his mind, a voice said, Congratulations. By your fortitude, you have been successful. A vast feeling pervaded him then, a sense of accomplishment. The odds against you were tremendous, the voice inside his mind continued.
Anyone else would have failed.
He knew then that everything was all right. They had been wrong.
What you have done here, the voice declared, you can continue to do all your life. You can always triumph over adversaries. By patience and persistence, you can win out. The universe isn't such an overwhelming place after all.
No, he realized with irony, it wasn't.
They are just ordinary persons, the voice soothed. So even though you're the only one, an individual against many, you have nothing to fear. Give it time. And don't worry.
I won't, he said aloud.
The humming receded. The voice was gone. After a long pause, Fowler said,
It's over.
I don't get it, Penario said.
That was what it was supposed to do, Wiseman said. It's a therapeutic toy. Helps give the child confidence.
The disassembling of the soldiers, he grinned, ends the separation between him and the world. He becomes one with it, and in doing so conquers it.
Then it's harmless, Fowler said.
All this work for nothing, Penario groused. To the bomb expert, he said,
I'm sorry we got you up here for nothing.
The Citadel had now opened its gates wide. 12 soldiers, once more intact, issued forth. The cycle was complete. The assault could begin again. Suddenly, Wiseman said,
I'm not going to release it.
What? Penario said.
Why not?
I don't trust it, Wiseman said.
It's too complicated for what it actually does.
Explain, Fowler demanded.
There's nothing to explain, Wiseman said.
Here's this immensely intricate gadget, and all it does is take itself apart and then reassemble itself.
There must be more. Even if we can't, it's therapeutic, Penario put in.
Fowler said,
I'll leave it up to you, Leon. If you have doubts, then don't release it. We can't be too careful.
Maybe I'm wrong, Wiseman said, but I keep thinking to myself, what did they actually build this for? I feel we still don't know.
And the American cowboy suit, Penario added. You don't want to release that either.
Only the game, Wiseman said. Syndrome, or whatever it's called.
Bending down, he watched the soldiers as they hustled toward the Citadel. Bursts of smoke again. Activity, feigned attacks, careful withdrawals.
What are you thinking? Penario asked, scrutinizing him.
Maybe it's a diversion, Wiseman said. To keep our minds involved, so we won't notice something else.
That was his intuition, but he couldn't pin it down. A red herring, he said.
While something else takes place.
That's why it's so complicated. We were supposed to suspect it.
That's why they built it.
Baffled, he put his foot down in front of a soldier. The soldier took refuge behind his shoe, hiding from the monitors of the Citadel.
There must be something right before our eyes, Fowler said, that we're not noticing.
Yes, Wiseman wondered if they would ever find it. Anyhow, he said, we're keeping it here, where we can observe it.
Seating himself nearby, he prepared to watch the soldiers. He made himself comfortable for a long, long wait.
At 6 o'clock that evening, Joe Houck, the sales manager for Apley's Children's Store, parked his car before his house, got out, and strode up the stairs. Under his arm, he carried a large flat package. A sample that he had appropriated.
Hey!
His two kids, Bobby and Laura, squealed as he let himself in.
You got something for us, Dad?
They crowded around him, blocking his path. In the kitchen, his wife looked up from the table and put down her magazine.
A new game I picked up for you, Houck said.
He unwrapped the package, feeling genial.
There was no reason why he shouldn't help himself to one of the new games. He had been on the phone for weeks getting the stuff through import standards, and after all was said and done, only one of the three items had been cleared. As the kids went off with the game, his wife said in a low voice, "More corruption in high places." She had always disapproved of his bringing home items from the store's stock.
"We've got thousands of them," Houck said. "A warehouse full. Nobody'll notice one missing."
At the dinner table, during the meal, the kids scrupulously studied every word of the instructions that accompanied the game. They were aware of nothing else. "Don't read at the table," Mrs. Houck said reprovingly. Leaning back in his chair, Joe Houck continued his account of the day. "And after all that time, what did they release? One lousy item. We'll be lucky if we can push enough to make a profit." It was that shock troop gimmick that would really have paid off, and that's tied up indefinitely. He lit a cigarette and relaxed, feeling the peacefulness of his home, the presence of his wife and children. His daughter said, "Dad, do you want to play? It says the more who play, the better." "Sure," Joe Houck said. While his wife cleared the table, he and his children spread out the board, counters, dice, and paper money and shares of stock. Almost at once he was deep in the game, totally involved. His childhood memories of game playing swam back, and he acquired shares of stock with cunning and originality, until toward the conclusion of the game he had cornered most of the syndromes. He settled back with a sigh of contentment. "That's that," he declared to his children. "Afraid I had a head start. After all, I'm not new to this type of game." Getting hold of the valuable holdings on the board filled him with a powerful sense of satisfaction. "Sorry to have to win, kids." His daughter said, "You didn't win."
"You lost," his son said.
"What?"
Joe Houck exclaimed.
"The person who winds up with the most stock loses," Laura said. She showed him the instructions. "See, the idea is to get rid of your stocks. Dad, you're out of the game."
"The heck with that," Houck said, disappointed.
"That's no kind of game."
His satisfaction vanished.
"That's no fun."
"Now, we two have to play out the game," Bobby said, "to see who finally wins."
As he got up from the board, Joe Houck grumbled,
"I don't get it.
What would anybody see in a game where the winner winds up with nothing at all?" Behind him, his two children continued to play. As stock and money changed hands, the children became more and more animated. When the game entered its final stages, the children were in a state of ecstatic concentration.
"They don't know Monopoly," Houck said to himself, "so this screwball game doesn't seem strange to them."
Anyhow, the important thing was that the kids enjoyed playing Syndrome. Evidently it would sell, and that was what mattered. Already the two youngsters were learning the naturalness of surrendering their holdings. They gave up their stocks and money avidly, with a kind of trembling abandon. Glancing up, her eyes bright, Laura said,
"It's the best educational toy you ever brought home, Dad."